welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We're always interested in your thoughts. Drop us a note to indianaweekend@gmail.com with your suggestions and comments. Let us know what's going on where you are. In something of a final footnote to the political season just ended, a reporting project by student journalists shows the depth of campaign finance contributions flowing through political action committees. The Indiana University Project shows that since 2000, state PACs in Indiana have taken in nearly $1 billion to run campaigns and influence elections. The reporting raises questions also about problems with the quality of information available to the public. We're talking about this today, along with the wider issue about the state public records law and how it affects all of us. Professor Jerry Lanoska, a former Ball State journalism professor who is also head of the Indiana Coalition for Open Government, led the IU project. We talked with him via Skype.
I had five student teams working. We had one team that did sort of a primer on just describing how does Indiana's campaign finance system work. It's been a long time, I think, in Indiana since I've seen a project that looks that has reported about the campaign finance system as a whole. So you've seen, you know, every year you see somebody do a story about the latest filings by the gubernatorial candidates, for instance, you get to know who was the biggest contributor and so forth. But very infrequently do we see a big project that explains to people, here's how this works. I think probably if you'd ask me about the biggest finding, I would say it's about the data. It's about the quality of the data. So we wanted to go into this, or we did go into this reporting project with an idea that we could do a story about 16 years worth of data and what is going on with money in Indiana politics. And we very quickly ran into the issue of dirty data. And one of the things I think it's really important for journalists to do is realize that sometimes parts of the reporting process, which ordinarily we might keep hidden from the public, sometimes become part of the story. So data is typically, you know, when you think about data journalism, data is typically thought of as a means to an end, a means to a story. We go get, underground storage tank data to be able to write a story about or put together a story about potential groundwater pollution by these leaky storage tanks. But if it's difficult to get the data, or if once you get the data, you find it's incomplete, it's dirty because of lack of standardization, or there's missing data, well, then maybe you pivot as a journalist and say, the story is partly about the substantive thing in the data, which is the underground storage tanks, but there's another story here, which is about the quality of the data itself, which, even though it's open to the public, doesn't really help the public understand the substantive fact of what's going on in there because it's so badly kept. And that was the case here. This data is very easily obtained by the public. You can search it, you can download it, you know, put it in an Excel spreadsheet and run pivot tables, or put it in a database manager and run queries to figure out stuff, what's going on in there. But the data quality is so bad that you can't actually get meaningful findings out of it. So that in itself became a centerpiece finding for this story, which was to say, the data became less of an end and more of, or less of a means to a story and more of the story itself.
We hear about the role of political action committees in campaign finance.
One of the big issues with Indiana campaign finance regulation is that individuals can contribute as much as they want. Political action committees can, by and large, contribute as much as they want. There are strict limits on corporations and labor unions. And actually, I should stop using the word strict. There are limits on what corporations and labor unions can do, but it's easy to get away around the limits. And one way they do that is by using PACs. So, for instance, one of the limits says that a corporation cannot give a governor's candidate more than $5,000 in 1 year. So just to make this concrete, if you're Eli Lilly and Company, corporate headquarters company, the main company over, you know, not counting all the subsidiaries, Eli Lilly and Company can give $5,000 to a governor's candidate in 1 year. So maybe they would give that to Mike Pence, just as an example. They're not supposed to give any more than that, but here's how they get around it and expand their influence. The corporate executives are individuals. They can give as much as they want. So you might have a corporate team at Lilly that includes a CEO, the the president and a whole fleet of vice presidents, and if they each give $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000 to the governor's candidate, then that obviously expands dramatically the influence that is credited to Eli Lilly, the company. The second way that they might do that is through a company PAC, and Eli Lilly has a company PAC. Strictly speaking, it's an employees PAC, so the money actually comes from employees, but the employees, who include executives, can contribute as much as they want to that political action committee. And then the PAC can turn around and give more money to that same candidate. So that 5,000 limit can expand pretty much without limit. And that was one of our big issues, was that we found the political action committees are really a tool for expanding influence in ways that get beyond the statutory limits.
So naturally, you'd wonder what people expect to receive in return for their contributions. Lanoska says documenting a quid pro quo isn't easy.
Well, you always run up against the issue of correlation and causation. So you can generally, it's very difficult to prove a quid pro quo, I guess is the short answer on that. And the reason is because you can see a beginning of a transaction and an end of a transaction, and you don't necessarily know what's in between those two elements that you can see in campaign finance data, and you don't get to see what happens before. You don't necessarily get to see what happens after. You can make some inferences, which is what we did a little bit of. One of the examples we looked at involved a big company called the GEO Group, G-E-O, GEO Group. It's a multinational private prison concern, and it has it does business with the state of Indiana and I think also some local governments in Indiana. And then they basically come in and they run prisons for government agencies. So they run a couple facilities here in Indiana for the Department of Correction. They contribute quite a lot of money. So we were able to find in the data going back to, I think, 2004, you start seeing contributions from the GEO Group. And as the business increases in Indiana, the business for this company to do business with Department of Correction, as that increases, the contributions are also increasing. So there's an inference there. You can't necessarily say this is a quid pro quo. There's nothing illegal about a company that contributes money to a governor's candidate. In this case, the contributions went to Mike Pence. And I think they've also contributed to Eric Holcomb, the governor-elect. You can't, based on the data, say that there is a quid pro quo, but it's suggestive that companies that contribute money also tend to get business from the state and from the agencies that that they're interested in. The other thing that we found is that, and this involved a little bit of digging, so trying to look at campaign contributions by date, for instance, can be very suggestive of fundraisers, for instance. So we found in 2015, I think it was in 2015, the fall of 2015, we noticed some big contributions being made by GEO Group, the corporation. Isolating the particular date on which some of these particular contributions were being made, we also found a bunch of names of individuals who had given the same amounts to the same candidates, in this case, particularly Mike Pence. And as you dug into that, you scratch behind the surface, you learn that many of those individuals are connected to GEO Group. So it's an example of what I mentioned with regard to how corporations can expand their influence beyond the statutory limits by having corporate executives contribute.
Professor Jerry Lanoska, who led a project looking at campaign finance in Indiana. He's also president of the Indiana Coalition for Open Government. His group examined 16 years of data from the Indiana Election Division, checking campaign filings for candidates for the General Assembly, the governor's office, and other statewide positions. Coming up, your rights to public records and how everyday people can use the law to track where their tax dollars are going.
Indiana Weekend, interesting people and places from across our region. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line. Let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com. Now here's John Strauss.
Talking about public records and how you are affected with the head of the Indiana Coalition for Open Government, Professor Jerry Lanoska. The law protects our rights to see most public records. Lanoska was an investigative reporter for WTHR in Indianapolis and the Indianapolis Star before pursuing his doctorate degree and switching to academia. One of his projects was about a sheriff's department and its pattern of writing tickets.
I like that one a lot because of the not only the use of records, but the use of data and the use of sort of creative reporting of the data to try to demonstrate something that's really difficult to document. So the issue was, the question that we were looking at was, does the Marion County Sheriff's Department have a quota? Do they require their office, their traffic officers, to issue a certain number of tickets as part of their job? That would be a ticket quota that that would be illegal. The department has always denied, most departments always deny that there's a quota that they require their officers to give a certain number of tickets. And so, but we were hearing about it all the time. We'd heard about it for years from officers working there. Yeah, there's a quota. Nobody's going to admit it from the front office, but there's a quota. We have to do a certain amount of tickets every year. And so we would hear this and, you know, sort of nibble at it from time to time. And finally, it dawned on us that we could ask for all of the ticket data over a period of years. And I can't remember how many years worth of data we got, but it was at least 5 years of data of all of the tickets that had been issued in Marion County, not just for the Sheriff's Department, but also for all of the other agencies, including Indianapolis Police Department, IPD at the time, the smaller agencies such as Speedway and Lawrence. And so we had tens of thousands of records in this data set of tickets that had been written. And so each row of data was a ticket. You had the date, you had the time, the location of the ticket, the person who got the ticket, the person who wrote the ticket, how much it was, what the infraction was. Really interesting, fun data. We were able to do a few stories out of it, including a look at where the hot spots were, where the speed traps were, and so forth, who the most productive officers were. And then with regard to the, there's nothing in the data that says there's a ticket quota. You can count up how many tickets have been issued by each officer and write that down and do a story about it. But then what we figured out was, well, if there's a quota, a monthly quota, as we were told, it might be, you might expect that there would be more tickets written toward the end of the month as officers were realizing they got to be productive, they've got to get all their tickets in. Maybe I've only written, 10 tickets so far this month and I'm supposed to do 30 or whatever it is. So I got to step up my production. I'm going to go out and nail 10 people today and 12 people tomorrow, and then I'll get my quota. And so we analyzed it by date. And it turned out to be the thing that allowed us to demonstrate, I won't use the word prove, but I think we demonstrated pretty effectively that there was, in fact, a spike in ticket production, ticket writing at the end of the month, at the end of every month. And it was very notable. So if you put it on a chart, it just goes up and down like this. Beginning of the month, end of the month. Beginning of the month, end of the month. And so we did a story basically making the contention that that the data showed that there was a ticket quota. And it was not a very popular story with the Sheriff's Department.
Jerry Lanoska has been looking at how well agencies comply with the law. So we wanted to know whether state and local governments are as open as they should be.
Let me describe a project we did last year in my investigative reporting class that looked at compliance with the public access statute. So we have a law that requires agencies to produce public records. There's a procedure you go through to get records. There's a time deadline at which, you know, agencies have to respond to a request and so forth. Most records that an agency has are public and are supposed to be released to requesters, whether it's a member of the public or a journalist. And we looked at the issue of compliance with the electronic request. So you can go into a public agency during business hours and ask for public records. They're supposed to give them to you on the spot, let you look at them on the spot if they're easily retrieved. A lot of times you can't go to the agency, so we have these wonderful computers these days. A lot of times people put in requests by email. We were very interested in looking at that particular issue. So when an agency gets an email, how well does it comply with the law? Does it respond in a timely fashion to the initial request? Then does it produce the records within a reasonable amount of time and so forth? We did a project basically testing that with agencies in all 92 counties, and compliance was very spotty. So we had instances where the email was just ignored. We had instances where the records, which were clearly public, there was no argument that the records we were asking for were confidential. We were denied access to those records. So the compliance was really pretty poor overall. And it points to a general attitude, I think, among public agencies that the records law is sort of a secondary issue for them, secondary to their primary duty. So a sheriff's department, for instance, might consider, they would naturally and rightly consider their primary function to be fighting crime. They go out and they stop speeders, they investigate murders, they are supposed to prevent robberies and rapes from happening and so forth. So that's their main reason for existence. Given that, the attitude that we frequently see from those agencies is that providing records to the public, whether it's students or journalists, is sort of secondary. And, you know, we'll get to that when we have time for it. And if we don't have time, well, that's just too bad because we're out solving crimes. That's our main function. And so there's always at those local agency levels, there's often a tendency to put public records requests to the side. And I think that's an attitude that filters down from the legislature as well. The legislature repeatedly has made the records law worse by adding more and more exceptions to disclosure. That happens just about every year. And so I think that general attitude toward public records as a secondary, not very important concern, sometimes that filters down to the local agency level and results in bad compliance.
Jerry Linoska, president of the Indiana Coalition for Open Government, talking about the degree to which public agencies comply with state records laws. Coming up, how everyday people can use the law to see how their tax money's being spent.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
Talking with Professor Jerry Linoska of IU today about his work with students examining the nearly $1 billion in campaign contributions flowing to Indiana candidates since 2000. He's also president of the Indiana Coalition for Open Government, and he has advice for people who want to monitor what local government's doing. His recommendations for reporters sound like good advice for anybody trying to understand where their tax dollars are going.
The main thing is to wire the system. And by that, I mean getting to know really how everything works or is supposed to work. Like, you should be able to answer the question, who are the power brokers? And not just the policymakers, such as mayors and city council members and chamber of commerce leaders and so forth, but who are the real people who are influential in the community? You should go talk to those people and interview those people. Part of that wiring process is also knowing about public records. So you should know up, down, sideways, what are the records that are relevant to your area of coverage. So let's just, for sake of the example here, assume that you're assigned to cover a small town in central Indiana, Franklin, Indiana. I know a guy who was once a young man assigned to Franklin, Indiana. That was me. 1988. So you should go there and figure out, here are the key agencies I'm interested in, and then find out what records do they have. Most people know the police reports, you know, budgets, everyone thinks of emails, memos, but there are a lot of records that reporters never look at that you can find out about too by making a request. So you could go to the city government, the administration agency, sometimes it's the mayor's office, there might be a department of administration, and ask for a list of forms, all of the forms that are maintained by the unit of government. Those forms can include inspection records, they can include interdepartmental things that have to be filled out. They will include those ones that everyone knows about, police reports and so forth. But usually there are dozens, if not hundreds, of these things, many of which reporters never look at. And so it's a way to figure out what are all the categories and specific forms of records that exist and what's on them. Find out what they do and then start asking for those things. In some cases, you can go to the website. So if you go to the state of Indiana, for instance, forms.in.gov, is an online catalog of forms. It's a database. You can search it by keyword, or you can look by agency. So you could go to the Department of Natural Resources, for instance, and look at all of the forms that are maintained by the agency. And then you can also download a copy of the form. So what you'll see is, for instance, it might be state form number 10253, revised January of 2014, and you'll get a blank form. And maybe it's the form that reports groundwater spills, toxic groundwater spills. Now you know that there's a form that is specific to that certain subject, and nobody can ever tell you that there's not a form. You can ask for the form by number. You can say, I want to see all these forms for the last 10 years. Or, better yet, I want to see all the data that is produced from these forms, because usually what happens is a form is filled out, and then the information is dropped into a database.
Jerry Linoska's advice for reporters covering government, advice that could also be useful for neighborhood groups and other everyday folks who want to know what's going on where they live, where their tax money's going, and how decisions that affect them are being made. A little different for us on Indiana Weekend, but as lawmakers meet in Indianapolis, public access laws are always in the mix. Keeping them strong protects our right to know what public officials are doing. If you want to know more about that, the Indiana Coalition for Open Government is a good place to start, along with the Hoosier State Press Association. By the way, so glad you can join us on Indiana Public Radio, your home for local news and information in East Central Indiana. Your friends Stan Sollers, Stephanie Weekman, and Stephen Turpin bringing the latest information and classical music on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Morning Musical, and local programs like Community Connection, The Scene, Indiana Weekend, and now The Owsley Moment. But IPR's biggest resources are community of listeners and members. You make the difference. If you're not a member yet or you haven't checked in lately, please consider supporting your local radio. Give us a call at 1-800-646-1812 or join us online at indianapublicradio.org. And thanks. And that's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Sean Ashcraft, and the folks in the front office, including your friends Matt Bloom, Connie Clary, Lori Georgie, Emily Kowalski, Andrea Lutz, John Morgan, Angie Rapp, Debbie Webb, Alicia Franklin, and Elena McKenzie. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Sean Ashcraft. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from IPR's listeners. We hope you'll join your friends who are IPR members. You can go to indianapublicradio.org or give us a call at 1-800-646-1812. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.